Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
So good to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we're going to talk about Southern California businesses that received PPP loans from the federal government and those who didn't. And if you have a business that applied for PPP funding, I want to hear whether you got it or not, what you thought of the process of getting it, and how you used it at your business. KPCC reporter Sharon McNary is taking a deep dive into how that PPP federal money has been distributed here in California. That's coming up later this hour, and we'll talk with Denise Hamilton about the new book she's edited, Speculative Los Angeles. It's a chance for you to share your favorite stories about Los Angeles that you think provide the best sense of place, that really taught you something about your city or really gave you a sense of authenticity around it. I know for me, Walter Mosley's E.Z. Rollins detective stories have been wonderful, set in South Los Angeles and really giving a sense of place of that community, Devil in a Blue Dress and all the books that came afterward. Right now, we turn our attention to the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing George Floyd, who went on trial this morning. Prosecutors showed the jury video of Derek Chauvin pressing his knee on George Floyd's neck for several minutes as onlookers yelled at him repeatedly to get off, the video showing Floyd gasping that he couldn't breathe. Opening statements, prosecutor Jerry Blackwell told the jury the number to remember was 9 minutes, 29 seconds, the amount of time that Chauvin had Floyd pinned to the pavement with his knee last May. Blackwell also, in giving the opening argument for the state, read portions of the oath that Minneapolis police officers take when they're sworn in. And prosecutor Blackwell said Officer Chauvin violated that oath during his encounter with George Floyd.
Mr. Derek Chauvin betrayed this badge when he used excessive and unreasonable force upon the body of Mr. George Floyd, that he put his knees upon his neck and his back, grinding and crushing him until the very breath, no, ladies and gentlemen, until the very life was squeezed out of him. You will learn that he was well aware that Mr. Floyd was unarmed, that Mr. Floyd had not threatened anyone, that Mr. Floyd was in handcuffs. He was completely in the control of the police. He was defenseless.
In his opening statement, defense attorney Eric Nelson, who's representing former officer Chauvin, told jurors they'd be hearing a lot of discussion about reason and common sense over the course of the trial and employed the jurors to make their judgments based on the evidence presented.
Common sense tells us that we need to examine the totality of the circumstances to determine the meaning of evidence and how it can be applied to the questions of reasonableness of actions and reactions. In other words, common sense is the application of sound judgment based upon a reasoned analysis. And that's what this case is ultimately about. It's about the evidence in this case. The evidence that you will see in this case during this trial, it is, I agree with counsel for the state, it is nothing more than that. There is no political or social cause in this courtroom.
And of course, these opening statements from the prosecution and defense laying out themes that we're going to be hearing over the months to come in the criminal trial of former Officer Chauvin. Joining us to talk about how the case is likely to be presented and the challenges that each side faces is Deputy Public Defender with Los Angeles County, Philip Dubay. Thank you so much, Mr. Dubay, for joining us. We appreciate it. What's your sense just on what you've heard so far about how the openings have been laid out? It's gone much as you expected.
It has indeed. It's not unpredictable. This is indeed the trial of the millennium. All eyes are on the Twin Cities. There's gavel-to-gavel coverage right now in everybody's living room. I think both sides laid out a pretty good roadmap of what to expect. The issues for the defense are going to be as follows, really. Was there an unreasonable or unlawful use of force? And certainly causation. What was in fact the cause of death? What all eyes are going to be focusing on is whether or not the knee that was put on Mr. Floyd's neck was a lawful restraint. Was that a lawful restraint, that neck restraint, to be used in the officer's discretion when appropriate? And it's my understanding under Minnesota law, at least for that precinct, for that particular department, there is in their use of force manual an authorized neck restraint to be used in the officer's discretion when appropriate. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
We did hear, though, in the prosecution's opening statement, the length of time the knee was on top of Mr. Floyd's neck. And so I wonder if that is an anticipation of that defense strategy to show that even if in the department the use of the knee is an acceptable use of force, that the duration of its use with the protestations from Mr. Floyd made it a criminal act.
Well, then it goes to causation. What were, in other words, did what occur subsequent to the use of the neck occur independent of the use of the knee in the neck? So in other words, was there a superseding cause for Mr. Floyd's death? Was there something other than that use of force that occurred? So for example, there's going to be testimony about underlying health conditions that Mr. Floyd lived with. So, for example, I believe there's going to be evidence that he had coronary artery disease, hypertension, not to mention the fact that he had ingested, at least according to the forensics and the toxicology screen, a mixture of methamphetamine and fentanyl, which could be a lethal cocktail. If you combine those effects of the illicit street drugs with the coronary heart disease and the hypertension, the real issue for the jury at that point is going to be, was the hyperventilation, if you will, and the excitement of being restrained a substantial cause of death, a substantial factor leading to the cause of death, or was it insubstantial? So I anticipate there's going to be questions of the forensic pathologist and all the other experts, not to mention the defense forensic pathologist, to whether or not Mr. Floyd would have died anyway from the effects of the drugs and his coronary heart disease. If, in fact, he could have or would have died anyway, then if you think about it, the use of the neck restraint with the knee is sort of ancillary. It wasn't really a substantial cause in the man's death. So there's going to be issues for this jury to have to contend with, specifically the unlawful use of force, whether or not it was unreasonable, or in fact whether it was lawful, and causation.
We're talking with Philip Dubay, Deputy Public Defender with Los Angeles County. Also with us from the University of Southern California, Gould School of Law, professor and frequent Air Talk guest, Jody Armour. Professor, great to have you back with us.
Always good to be with you, Larry.
So, and what you were able to hear this morning of the opening arguments, did it go much as you expected it would?
Oh, yeah, I agree. I agree very much with Philip that the argument by the defense is going to be, number one, the defendant did nothing wrong, Chauvin did nothing wrong, And number two, if he did something wrong, and I think you pointed out the strongest argument for, yes, he did something wrong, even if there is a restraint policy in the police, literature somewhere, the amount of time he maintained the restraint under the circumstances, et cetera, made it unreasonable and egregious. Once you get beyond that, whether or not it was wrong, and, again, you can go both ways. I think you pointed out the strongest arguments for it being wrong. Then there's going to be the argument, well, but no harm, no criminal liability. If we didn't cause harm, if he would have died anyway, if you can't say that but for our wrongdoing, he would have been all right, then you can't prove causation. So, yeah, they're going to try to say something about his underlying health conditions, hypertension, that he had drugs and the like, right? And try to make and say that broke the causal chain in some way. But, that's a curious argument. It doesn't cut any ice, Larry, in tort law, for example, and in criminal law when it comes to felony murder rule, which is one of the rules they're using in this case. I have a case I teach in class, TAMP, in which there's a robbery that occurs. The storekeeper is taken into a room, told to stay until the robber leaves. He was overweight. He has a heart attack. He dies. And the robber is guilty of murder in the stamp jurisdiction. You take your victim a lot of times as you find them is how some courts approach these things. The eggshell condition, the eggshell skull of the victim is something that you take. So if someone has asthma, Larry, for example, and the police say, well, he or she had really bad case of asthma, and yeah, my knee was on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, but it was the asthma that caused the death. Well, maybe so, but a lot of people are going to say, but don't you know that a lot of citizens have asthma, and why would you lean on a neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, even if the asthma was one of the precipitating causes? So all that's going to be gone into, Larry.
So, Professor, where then does the defensible need of the officer to do it? I mean, how does that factor in? So let's say a Minneapolis Police Department allows for the use of a knee hold. We've got, it sounds like, clear evidence from the autopsy that you had these, there was a medical fragility in George Floyd, the ingestion of drugs. But if as you're saying, that what the officer did pushed him over, took his life, he wouldn't otherwise have died despite these other things. And if the prosecution shows it was not necessary for the officer to use his knee for that prolonged period of time, then to you, does that factor into it, whether this was necessary to restrain him so long?
Oh, absolutely. That's going to be the key question of whether or not the conduct was wrongful in the first place. And then if it was unnecessary to knee on his neck that long, then you have a wrongful act. And then we can get into the causation questions of whether that wrong caused his death. They're going to say, no, it was justified somehow. They'll go back and forth. But assuming they do, the jury concludes that it was wrongful, then we have this whole causation conundrum that we're going to get into. And at the end of the day, you kind of know where this is going, Larry. A lot of times we make our causation determinations, which sound like factual judgments, on the basis of our gut, on the basis of our moral judgments, on the basis of our normative responses. And so how much they care for the life of the victim here, Floyd, how much they care for the defendant, how much sympathy they have for either will play a role in how they determine causation.
We're talking with USC Law School Professor Jody Armour and Los Angeles County Deputy Public Defender Philip Dubay with us. Mr. Dubay, how central is that issue going to be as to whether it was a reasonable judgment of the officer to need to restrain George Floyd for that length of time?
Keep in mind that the use of force manual for that precinct has no temporal duration. In other words, for how long you are allowed to use that restraint. It's whatever is necessary under the circumstances. What the forensics will show, and by the way, the forensics are going to be the closest thing to an eyewitness other than that video. The forensics are going to show that Mr. Floyd had absolutely no injury to his throat anatomy. He had no petechial hemorrhaging, which is basically a bursting of the capillaries within the whites of the eyes. That is like a classic strangulation type symptom, if you will. A lot of people took offense at the officer's use of the knee in the neck because he stood there or leaned there, if you will, with his hands in his pockets, almost as if he was very calm. But I think what they're going to do is they're going to show that the calm use of the knee showed that he was not exerting extra pressure on the man's neck. It was just enough to keep him restrained until the backup and the ambulance arrived. So the issue is going to be, why isn't there a temporal component to the use of force? In other words, how much time are you allowed to use to restrain somebody? And does the absence of evidence showing that there was a true strangulation tend to exonerate the officer? And I suspect that the jury is going to struggle with the absence of the evidence to the throat, because in a true strangulation, in a true neck compression, in a true asphyxiation, you would see some type of harm or lesion within the hyoid bone, the uvula, the pharynx, the larynx, the styloid processes, something within the neck and the throat anatomy. And if you don't have that, then the jury's going to wonder, well, then what on earth killed the man?
Well, yeah, I guess it sounds like you're saying, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, that if pressure on the neck does not restrict breathing unless it gets to the severity where there's observable damage from an autopsy. But I didn't think that was the case. I thought breathing could be obstructed before you have visible damage. So can you elaborate?
Case. If that were the case, Larry, and I suspect that there's going to be testimony either from the forensic pathologist or the otolaryngologists or phoneticians, et cetera, to say that a person cannot phonate when their airflow is cut off, meaning they cannot utter words. If I am truly strangling somebody or if I am being strangled, you physically cannot utter words. The only thing that would come out would be, somebody sounding like they're gasping for air as opposed to enunciating or actually pronouncing words.
Okay. Hold on. That's Philip Dubé, Deputy Public Defender with L.A. County, USC Law Professor Jody Armour. Professor, how much of this is going to come down to dueling medical authorities arguing about this issue of neck compression?
Oh, yeah, you know, it's going to play a role, Larry. There's going to be a question about factually whether, you know, it's the case that by some freak coincidence, Larry, you know, by some freakish coincidence that he just happened to die at the same moment that the officer had his knee on his neck. But it wasn't from the officer having his knee on his neck or anything the officer was doing. It was just a freakish coincidence, Larry. You know, so yeah, you know, that argument, there's no causal connection at all, will be attempted to be made. Sometimes it prevails. It might prevail here. But you can also see how it could go the other way very easily. And it's going to really come down to, you know, what the jury, the jury's judgment at the end.
Giles writes on the page, how can the defense argue the use of force was necessary, and also that George Floyd was so near death that he was liable to die anyway? Wouldn't that make a knee on the neck completely unnecessary, and instead the officer should have been administering aid to George Floyd, not restraint? Giles, I think that would presume that the officer knew that Floyd was close to death, and I don't know whether that would have been obvious or not. Professor, can you comment on Giles's point?
There, you nailed it. That's it. You know, he's going to argue that there was nothing observable that made me think that he had those underlying conditions, that eggshell skull, if you will, and I didn't discover until after the fact.
All right. Well, I appreciate it very much, both of you being on and offering your analysis of this. We appreciate it very much. And I just want to emphasize that Philip Dubé is offering this as his own analysis. He's not speaking on behalf of the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. We appreciate, Mr. Dubé, your being with us. Thank you so much today. Also, our thanks to USC Law School professor Jody Armour, a frequent guest with us on Air Talk, and we'll be, throughout the course of the trial of former Officer Chauvin, be talking about the murder trial and the killing of George Floyd, which of course led to a series of protests against police brutality and racial injustice across the country, including here in Southern California. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about PPP, federal loans to Southern California businesses. I want to hear from you. Did you apply for and get a loan? Did you apply for and not get a loan? Share with us what the process was like, what you used the money for, and if you didn't get it, why you might have been turned down. 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back with our reporter, Sharon McNary, in just 1 minute.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.